You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, N104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Brilliant, boisterous, bookish Bob Batchelor is my guest. He's just published Stan Lee, The Man Behind Marvel, a biography of the man who created some of the best comic books in history, including Spider-Man, The Fantastic Four, The Hulk, and Night Nurse. Bob Batchelor, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you, Gary. I'm glad to be here.
I'm a comic book fan. I started collecting comic books in 1966. And I started actually with Superboy, but a friend of mine, his name was Matt, and he had a copy of Spider-Man number 10, I think it was, maybe it was 11, Peter Parker Unmasked by Dr. Octopus. And he read it to me, and it was so good. I thought, well, that's better than what's going on in Superboy, because nothing much was going on in Superboy. And so I switched my allegiance from DC to Marvel. But what you've now that you've written about Stan Lee, what was it that elevated what Stan Lee did in comics from what had been done before?
I think what Stan Lee did is he had a pretty good pulse on young people. And he had the insight to give superheroes human qualities. And that really separated Marvel, early Marvel, from what people had been reading, particularly Superman and all the Superman offspring and Batman and all the Batman offspring. So somebody like Spider-Man comes along, or the Thing from the Fantastic Four, and suddenly they're squabbling, and Spider-Man has girl problems in high school. And so readers could connect with this kind of idea because we all knew people like that. Nobody knew somebody like Superman. Nobody was as ingenious as Batman. These were more like gods than people. But Marvel was able to, and Stan Lee particularly with his amazing artist and production team, to give these superheroes the kind of human traits that gave everybody an avenue into the Marvel books.
Also, you know, every episode of Superboy or Superman or Lois Lane or whatever ended, and then the next story began as if the story before had never happened. I mean, there was no continuity, no impact, but every issue of Spider-Man led into the next one.
Yeah, that was important. That was an important aspect of the Marvel comic books, because people were getting more comfortable with that kind of episodic nature of storytelling. And so what was going on in Marvel comic books, people were getting used to on television. They were getting used to through movie sequels. Long-form storytelling was important, and Stan Lee and his crew were able to capitalize on that changing notion of what storytelling could be at that time.
Now, when I was reading comics in those days, there were no good comic book toys, and there were no good comic book movies or adaptations. In fact, the adaptations of Marvel comics in the cartoons were so bad that they didn't even have any animation. They were just pictures. Pictures from the comic with like the mouth moving or the eyes blinking. It's not like it is today. He's operating in a completely different environment.
Yeah, the early efforts at creating live action, they just didn't have the technology to make it seem realistic. I grew up in an era where Spider-Man was appearing on the Electric Company, and you know, as a young kid, that was pretty phenomenal to me, just to see the character. But the character didn't actually do anything. The spider webs were incredibly unrealistic. The early superhero animation cartoons were all fairly weak. But for me, there was still at that time a wonderment with seeing that kind of thing. I remember watching the old reruns of the old Superman show, the black and white show, and the campy Batman, and even that was interesting to my young mind. I guess I didn't care at that age much about the reality of how it looked or whether Batman, you know, Adam West was a super steroided up, bulked up guy. But yeah, certainly a different day and age now with, you know, a young person can be a superhero in video games. They, you know, inundated with superheroes across television and film, and the lifelike nature is certainly an important part with the computer graphics that they're able to do now. So it's quite a change, and it's almost unimaginable to think where Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko and the other great artists, where they were in, you know, 61, 62, 63, you know, those early days.
Well, Bob Batchelor, tell us about that. How did Stan Lee come to create this wonderful Marvel universe, which he created, I mean, with the aid of all those artists, but in terms of the writing, he was writing almost every title. So how did he get to Marvel, and what was he doing there before he created the Fantastic Four?
The amazing thing about Stan Lee's story is that it begins so much earlier than people would imagine. I mean, the story goes back to Stan Lee before he was actually Stan Lee. He was just Stan Lee, S-T-A-N-L-E-Y, Lieber, you know, a poor Jewish kid coming out of New York City looking for a job after he graduates from high school, and happening to stumble upon a job at a distant relative publishing company. When he walked in the door as a young teenager, Stan Lee really didn't even have much experience with comic books. He just knew that he wanted to be a writer, and he wanted to work with words, and this was an avenue into that kind of lifestyle. What he really wanted even more was to a steady job to make some money, because his parents were so poor and they needed help. So from 1939 to 1960, with only a couple years off during World War II, Stan Lee is working for Marvel, which had gone through a series of different names, ultimately resulting in Marvel, working in the comic division, often moonlighting as an editor for other kinds of magazines, particularly comic funny magazines that were kind of a precursor to, say, maybe Mad Magazine, or a precursor maybe even to Playboy, those kind of magazines. And the whole time, he's gaining experience. He's struggling at times because comic books were not always very popular. They were looked down upon and frowned upon. And that's where we have Stan Lee emerging. You know, he's, you know, the oldest one-hit wonder in the early 60s that could possibly be. I mean, he's close to 40 whenever he and Jack Kirby bring the Fantastic Four into the world. So it's amazing that Stan Lee has lived so long. He seems like he's been with us forever. He had an entire career in comic books before he ever really became famous at all.
And for a guy who was such an innovator in the comic book field, he was considerably less than an innovator for the first, you know, 30 years, right?
Yeah, he was basically following his publisher, who was, you know, like I mentioned, a distant relative, Martin Goodman. He was following his orders, and at times when comic book sales were good, he would, Stan Lee would get some leeway and can introduce new titles and things like that, but They weren't the kind of comic books that we imagine today. They were really geared toward kids. Martin Goodman thought that comic books were primarily for very young children, you know, under the age of 10, and imbecilic adults. And that's what he wanted his comic books geared toward. And so, I like to say that, you know, Martin Goodman was in the game of moving vast mountains of paper. To him, comic books were just another commodity that he could sell, and he had really no love for comic books. It was just a way to make money. And in Stan Lee, he found somebody who would follow his orders, who could run a tight ship, who could, you know, turn a profit. And that's really what we have Stan Lee doing from the time he takes over as editor of what was then Timely Comics, in the late 30s through the late 50s.
But Stan Lee did love comics, yes?
Yes, he came to love comic books. And I think toward the late 50s, after the comic book scare of the 50s and sales were kind of plummeting and the industry looked like it was really on the verge of collapse, I think it gave him pause. He had loved comic books, but, you know, he's getting close to 40 years old, and I think, you know, there's plenty of evidence that shows he was ready to quit. He was ready to move on to other things. You know, Stan Lee could have easily gone into television writing. He potentially could have been a novelist. He could have gone into any number of other careers, gone off and edited magazines or something like that. He was really right on the verge of leaving comic books for good when he kind of took a flyer on the Fantastic Four and it paid off for him.
You know, we often hear about great comedy teams like Martin and Lewis and Abbott and Costello not really liking each other. They were kind of enemies. And I guess I was sort of disappointed to read in your book that Stan Lee, the man behind Marvel, that Stan Lee and his partner, Jack Kirby, who created the Fantastic Four and Thor and the Hulk and so many others, didn't like each other very much.
You know, I think they liked each other in the beginning. They had a very complicated relationship, like so many great creative teams do. And the challenge, I think, you know, you've really struck at kind of the crux of, you know, people are really fanatical about comic books now. They put them in themselves in pro-Lee or anti-Lee or pro-Kirby, anti-Kirby camps. And they seem to put up a brick wall that's insurmountable to any other perspective. One of the goals that I had in writing Stan Lee, the man behind Marvel, was to present as objective as I could a historical perspective on Lee's career, and I really spent some time looking into this relationship because it's so built up with rumor and innuendo and faulty memories and then later lawsuits and things like that that it's really been burdened for, you know, 50 years of weight of life events, because when Stan Lee and Jack Kirby got together in the early 60s, they were both at the end of their rope. Jack Kirby had nowhere else to go. He had burned all of his bridges in comics, and Stan Lee was about to quit. And so out of this desperation, they kind of winged it. They just said, okay, let's do the kind of comic books that we would want to read and then see what happens. And they took this flyer, and thankfully for the comic book world and pop culture, it paid off. I think they grew to dislike each other because they were such different individuals. They both were deeply proud. They both wanted probably more of the credit for what happened than either one of them would have deserved individually. But I try in the book to take a very middle-of-the-road approach. For me personally, I'm a words guy. And so, to me, Marvel was not the pictures. Even when I was a little kid, it was the voice of the comic books. It was Spider-Man, smart alecky comebacks and things like that. Iron Man's wit, you know, those kind of things. Other people are just as interested in the art, and they may find themselves, you know, more in the Kirby camp, but it's a very convoluted relationship, and it grew more bitter as the decades went on.
Well, in your book, you hint or indicate that it's possible that the animosity between them dates all the way back to the 1940s, when Stan Lee knew a secret about Kirby that he might have revealed to his boss.
Certainly, yeah. When, you know, what I think a lot of current Marvel fans don't know is that when Stan Lee is that crazy high school graduate looking for a job, he gets into Timely Comics through a cousin of a cousin, you know, ultimately reaching up to Martin Goodman. But Joe Simon was the editor-in-chief of what was then Timely, and Jack Kirby was the artist. Kirby and Simon were a creative team. And so Lee is hired as the office boy. And it's a very convoluted story, but basically Kirby and Simon create Captain America. And that becomes the character that puts Marvel, Timely then, on the map. And Goodman supposedly wasn't paying Simon and Kirby all the royalties that he was supposed to be paying on that book, because nobody expected it to sell a million copies a month. And that's what ended up happening. It became bigger for a time than Superman, Batman, the other DC comic books. So Kirby and Simon got upset, and they signed a contract to go work for DC, but they were still kind of they were still primarily engaged with Marvel, but they were on their way to DC, and depending on who you believe in the story, Stan Lee, as their office boy, he kind of knew they were moonlighting and dipping into both sides of the equation, and the rumor is that people in Lee's family, some of Goodman's cousins, found out about this, and what ended up happening is that Kirby and Simon got fired and then went to Marvel. That firing and the fact that nobody could then fill Joe Simon's role as editor-in-chief led to Stan Lee being named editor-in-chief at about 18, 19 years old. And what seemed to be just a momentary fill-in kind of role ended up, you know, lasting most of his adult life. So, yeah, that secret, you know, nobody knows for sure. Most of the parties are long dead. There's no paper trail, but there's a lot of rumor and innuendo, and that may have been the beginning of the end for Kirby and Lee, but no one can really be 100% sure.
Well, you've met Stan Lee. Did he work with you on the book? Did he grant you interviews and so forth?
You know, I purposely did not seek Stan Lee's authorization. I wanted to write this book from a historical perspective. And I'm a cultural historian and biographer by training. I've spent my whole life doing this kind of work. I feel that often with biographies of living subjects, that the people that you interview and the individuals themselves, they're trying really hard to bend history to meet their current objectives. And so what I hope to do is, rather than base the book on interviews, you know, 100 or so interviews and interviews with Lee, I wanted to write an objective biography that was based in archival research. And so I spent quite a bit of time going through the Stan Lee archive, which is ironically in the American Heritage Center at the University of Wyoming. So spent some time out in the middle of nowhere in Laramie, Wyoming. I visited the Billy Ireland Cartoon Museum and Library at The Ohio State University. I went to various other smaller facilities. Spent a lot of time reading old comic books, which thankfully we can get in electronic format now pretty easily. So I think, you know, maybe someday somebody will write the oral history or the oral biography of Stan Lee interviewing, you know, a couple hundred people, but that wasn't really my goal. I kind of wanted to set more of a historical record based on archival research, but I hope, you know, knock on wood, really readable, because I wanted Marvel fans who think that they know something about Stan Lee but aren't really that sure about who he is or why he's important, that they would learn something from this book.
This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. We're talking about Stan Lee, the creator of Marvel Comics, and we're discussing him with his biographer, Bob Batchelor. So the time came when Stan Lee wrote the Fantastic Four. Rather than retire from comics, he did it his own way, did the Fantastic Four, and invited or hired Jack Kirby to work with him, and Kirby was willing to come back and work for him?
Yeah. At that time, Kirby had burnt his bridges at DC, and so toward the end of the 50s, comic books, really, superhero comic books are not popular at all. Other forms of comic books are more interesting, ranging from westerns to, you know, movie star-related comic books, cartoon-related comic books, a lot of science fiction-y and monster kind of stuff. So Kirby comes back to Marvel, and he's freelancing, writing a lot of kind of O. Henry-ish kind of stories that are, you know, comic books were anthologies back then, so there may be 8 to 10 short, you know, 4, 6, 8 page stories rather than what we're used to today and since the 60s. So it was a different kind of format. So when you look at the first issue of Fantastic Four, you know, there's a monster coming up out of the ground on the cover. This is kind of in the line. That's Lee and Kirby hedging their bets that they could reintroduce superheroes and gain some traction there while still appealing to the kind of the science fiction age that was happening at that time in the late 50s and early 60s. So Kirby comes back. Kirby's, you know, even though I take, you know, I think, you know, I, like I said, I'm a words guy. I'm probably, you know, I think people will think that I was probably a little too favorable to Lee in the book if they're big Kirby fans. But, you know, I don't think it's possible to be a comic book fan without, you know, paying homage to Jack Kirby. The guy was brilliant, and he was, you know, a lifetime of creating and co-creating characters, creating beautiful imagery. He was the perfect artist to bring the Fantastic Four to life. He was a great storyteller on his own. So, I mean, Kirby's the kind of guy who could have done anything, you know, if he were alive today, or would have been in a, you know, a younger man in the 70s and 80s, he probably would have been somebody like George Lucas or a great director or something like that. So this team, when they come back together, they're desperate. Lee and Kirby come together. The Fantastic Four, they put it out there, and it took a while for anybody to know that it was successful because they didn't have the technology to know what kind of sales were being generated right away. But what happened is that fans started writing letters saying how much they love the Fantastic Four. This had never happened before for Marvel. They never got letters, but suddenly letters start pouring in. They knew it was going to be a hit, and that launched everything.
And it's also interesting in your book that this golden age of Marvel, I guess the silver age of comics, as people refer to it now, in which all of these characters that we love and they're now dominating the movie screens were introduced, they only had 7 titles or 8 titles. How many titles a month did they publish?
Well, this is one of the most shocking aspects of in Marvel's history. Martin Goodman had his own distribution company, and Marvel was putting out 60, 70, 80 titles a month. And they're just flooding the market. And because, well, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Martin Goodman operated in quantities. He wanted mass quantities of paper being moved. Well, he shut down his distribution and went with a competitor just as that competitor was falling apart. And so within a few short weeks, Marvel Comics basically had no distributor. And without a way to get the comic books into the newsstands, the company was going to go under. It got so bad that they had to go to Independent News, which was part of the DC empire. And DC was afraid that they would be labeled a monopolist if they didn't distribute Marvel books. But they put a very serious, stringent number. I think it was maybe 12 or so, something like that, 10, 12 comics that they could put out a month. And so Marvel went from, you know, dozens and dozens of comic books to a very short number. So anytime they had to introduce a new character or a new title, they had to eliminate something else. And that's why every decision that Lee was making about which title to put out, and the effort that it took to put each title out really became part of his legacy of success. Because if a title failed, Marvel no longer had the kind of buffer through mass quantities that it could sustain any kind of loss. So it's another aspect of Lee that people really don't understand. I mean, that hardcore publishing executive and in kind of understanding from an editorial and a business perspective how magazines and comic books work really paid off in those early years. That hindered Marvel for a long time. They were under that distribution, that really poor distribution set up with independent news for a long time. It wasn't until they were able to break through that and independent news realized in the late 60s that they could make a lot of money off Marvel comic books that all changed and they got a new contract.
Well, one of the innovations of Stan Lee during that period that's made the comics so great was the idea of this bullpen of all these guys hanging out together with their ties loosened and loving comics, loving each other, hanging out, and the fact that all the characters were part of that, as if they all existed in this one world, and these guys, this crazy bullpen, were all pals. It was and it was conveyed not only in the editorial pages of the book, but actually in the panels of the comic.
Yeah. So it's pretty amazing that Kirby and Lee, they show up quite frequently in the comic books. And this was an innovation that I thought Stan Lee really capitalized on. He broke that fourth wall, and he spoke to the reader in a way that made you feel like something really interesting. Like if you didn't keep up with what was going on, you were somehow missing out. I was a poor kid growing up in western Pennsylvania, and I had no conception what New York City was. I had very little conception outside of seeing comic books what that world could have even meant. But through Stan Lee's soapbox columns and through the imagery of the bullpen and the way that Stan Lee spoke to the audience, I felt like if I didn't watch and I didn't keep up, that I'd be missing something really important. Like there was something fundamental going on at Marvel that just, you know, had to keep up with. And I never felt like that before with DC and reading DC comics. And so I think that drawing in and it's one of the great things that they did by using New York City rather than Metropolis or Gotham City or, you know, these fictional cities, putting the Fantastic Four right in the heart of New York City and putting Peter Parker in Queens. It gave people a realistic perspective that went right hand in hand with the way that Lee spoke through that imaginary wall that traditionally had separated the reader from the creators. And I think that was happening in culture anyhow. I mean, people were used to that kind of voiceover narration in film and in television, certainly in radio shows. So I think, you know, I tried to stay pretty much as chronological as I could in the Stan Lee biography. I think somebody could write an entire different book about, you know, Marvel as a cultural history and how the introduction of comic books was tying into film and television and literature at the time. So there's a lot of interesting things that Stan Lee certainly had his finger on the pulse. If he wasn't innovating, he was certainly picking things up in other mediums that he brought to the comic books for the benefit of Marvel.
You think that Stan Lee used thought balloons more than previous comic books had used?
I think that he did. I think he did, and he tried purposely, you know, on the cover of Amazing Fantasy number 15, when Spider-Man, you know, is introduced to the world, the story is almost told right on the front page in two thought balloons and a call-out box. And Stan Lee even says, an important message to you from the editor about the new Amazing. And so this pushing the idea that you're part of something exciting, and here's the story, and here's how we're going to deliver on it, I really think, separated Marvel from what was happening prior to the early 60s.
I remember an issue of Tales of Suspense, and I was reading the Iron Man story, and Tony Stark is sitting at a table, and his thought balloon says, here comes my secretary, Pepper Adams. And right below, Stan comments, we know people don't talk this way, but we think people maybe are reading this comic book for the first time. We don't want you to feel left out.
Yeah. Those little asides, the asterisks. I remember, Stan Lee would reference something in a thought balloon, and then there'd be an asterisk, and see Fantastic Four issue 63, and it was like, what it did for me, and I think what it did for, several generations of readers, is create a universe that seems so entwined. And this is another innovation that Lee pulled off, that they've really done a great job in the movies. It's kind of, pulling that idea into the current films. Marvel really is a universe, and these superheroes bump into each other. And, part of the power of the Marvel superheroes is that they know each other. So in, Amazing Fantasy 15, Spider-Man appears, his origin story there. It's only part of the magazine. It's only one little piece of several stories that have nothing to do with Spider-Man and nothing to do with superheroes. When they find out that Spider-Man's a hit and they introduce it as a standalone, the first issue on the cover is Spider-Man and the Fantastic Four. And so right away, as a reader, you're like, holy cow, these two worlds are colliding in a way that, you never would experience or never think. And then the whole universe just keeps getting built out in a fantastic way. So I think that's an important part of Lee's innovation, that maybe doesn't get enough credit for. But certainly you see that now with the movies, the recent Spider-Man Homecoming, Tony Stark, Robert Downey Jr. plays a huge role in the Thor movie that's coming out in a month or so. Hulk plays a starring role. And so this cross-pollination, which Lee and Kirby and Ditko were so good at, really plays a big role today in making all these superheroes come to life in a new way.
As a reader, it made you feel like you were missing something if you didn't read the next, if you didn't go to the next title, since they all knew each other. I even remember an episode of Fantastic Four where Dr. Doom took over the body of Daredevil. So it started in the Fantastic Four, and then it ended in Daredevil or vice versa. I can't remember exactly. But that was pretty innovative stuff, and, of course, it got you to spend another 12 cents, which is what they cost.
I think later in Marvel's history, maybe the early 2000s, some of that cross-pollination got a little much. I mean, you had to buy... you'd have to buy 15 comics a month to kind of keep up with a central storyline, and sometimes even more than that. But and some people, that's a criticism they have today, where you have to buy 24 comic books a month to really keep up with what's going on. But at the time, Marvel's putting out less books. There's more crossover. It's an innovation that's important. And I think anytime, kind of success breeds, a push for more, but
overuse. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with Bob Batchelor. He's the author of Stan Lee, The Man Behind Marvel. Stan Lee was the creator of Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, the Incredible Hulk, and Iron Man. Well, today the comics are so different. I mean, there was when I mentioned Tales of Suspense, which had two stories. It started with an Iron Man story and then had a Captain America story. And there's more story in a single issue of the half Captain America issue of Tales of Suspense than there is in six issues of Captain America now. They were dense with words, and they don't tell very much story now. They have a lot of pictures and not as many words.
Yeah, I think anybody, you know, I'm a Gen Xer, and so, you know, I certainly see that, and I teach millennials as a college prof, and I lament the lack of in-depth reading probably as much as anybody on the planet. So I'm really keen on that. And when I started this project, one of the things that I really love is that Marvel put out has a digital unlimited, essentially. It's like less than $100 a year, and you can go back way, way, way into the archives. So I started reading comic books as far back as they have uploaded. I, you know, read all, you know, first couple hundred issues of Spider-Man, things like that. I agree with you completely. The stories were so dense and so interesting versus what's happening today. The comics have risen in price exponentially, and the stories are much simpler, much more slang-oriented, perhaps. I don't know.
There's a lot of grammatical errors now. One of the things that always thrilled me about Stan Lee was his use of, I mean, he had the characters talking in vernacular, but he also used really good vocabulary. I remember hearing the word, the ubiquitous Green Goblin, and I thought, what is ubiquitous? And I had to, you know, look it up. He really pushed the boundaries of, you know, the 11-year-old mind, and that's how he tapped into the college mind, I guess.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's kind of purpose on purpose. It's kind of accident. Maybe it's a happy coincidence in part. Stan Lee certainly wanted to go after older readers, and you see that in interviews that he gave, and you see, you know, he's talked about that. It's another innovation that, you know, Martin Goodman's pushing him just to move paper and move it as fast as possible, and Stan Lee had the foresight to see, you know, the baby boom is happening. All these in the 60s, you know, there's three times as many people in college. These are all people who will buy comic books, and Stan Lee was able to capitalize on this, in part by creating these human characteristics within the superhero comic books and really interesting dramatic stories. But I agree with you completely. Using corny dialogue, using kind of aspirational vocabulary dialogue, a mix, and it worked. And time again, DC tried to copy this. They tried to copy the covers. They tried to copy the voice. They could never get it right. And maybe until Michael Keaton became Batman, that was the first time DC actually figured it out to some degree, you know, a voice that was kind of like Marvel. So I agree with you. The stories were thicker. They were more interesting. They were denser. I'm shocked sometimes in how little story is in a 23-page comic book that's out today that costs, you know, a significant amount of money. You know, it's certainly the days of 12 cents or a quarter or 50 cents. I mean, even we're long past a dollar. So, you know, it's a challenge.
Bob Batchelor, I'm not a very big fan of the Marvel films. They are never as good as the original comics on which they're based. There are too many villains, too many fight scenes, and way too many sequels.
Yeah. And I think, you know, part of that, again, is cultural. The, you know, the movie industry, even you know, mainstream novel industry, certainly the music industry, it's based on that blockbuster opening, you know. So everything is about the first 7 days or sometimes the first 3 days in terms of movies. That blockbuster mentality, it seems to appeal to people. You know, sometimes I feel like I'm just getting old too fast, because I would love just to see a great movie that's based on a relationship or a lifespan that's, I don't know, smaller in some ways. Because, you know, we don't have to have a villain that's trying to take over the world. We could just, you know, deal with smaller problems. And I think, you know, so many great novels, you know, address that really well. And that maybe is the kind of thing that Lee and Kirby and Ditko were doing.
Yeah,
they were saving the world, but they were still humans.
Yes, it's clear. You're old, Bob Batchelor. You're way too old to be reading comic books. You know, I think one of there is a negative perception of Stan Lee among some people. And I was talking with Dick Ayers, who was a great comic book illustrator. He inked Kirby's pencils, and he did his own penciling and inking on many great books from Marvel in the Golden Age and the Silver Age. And got to get our ages right. And the Bronze Age as well. And he told me once that he was working on Sergeant Fury, number 23 or something. And he said, Stan, he got him on the phone. He goes, I really need the script for this book. I don't have a script, and, you know, I've got to get it done. And Stan said, oh, Dick, you know these characters as well as I do. You can write it yourself. So he did. He wrote the story. He penciled the story. He inked the story. His wife lettered the story. And when the book was published, it said, written by Stan Lee, drawn by Dick Ayers. And Dick Ayers said, Stan, don't you think I should have gotten the writing credit on that book? And Stan said, what are you, an egomaniac?
Yeah, there are a lot of those stories around. You know, I address the Marvel method in the book. I've spent more hours and more time thinking about this issue than probably, you know, there's a handful of us on this entire planet who have spent this much time thinking about this issue. It's so convoluted. For every story that I hear like that, there's a counter story. And that's the challenge with, you know, what people don't think about, I think, often enough, is that nobody considered comic books great art back then. They, you know, like you mentioned earlier, the adaptations were awful, the animation was bad, there weren't that many toys, you know, it had not taken over popular culture. The time was not nostalgic for comic books. You know, they were certainly not collector's items. And so these were really not the artistic, I don't know, kind of collector's items that we think about today. Jack Kirby, Stan Lee, they're just trying to keep their jobs. They're trying to feed their family. They're trying to, you know, live the American dream. I think as Stan got more successful, there was certainly, you know, ego driving some of this, you know. I think anybody who's a, you know, 40-year-old person who's an overnight sensation, there's going to be some of this. The artist wanted some of the credit, more of the credit. You know, you had Goodman still around, you know, bossing everybody around. It's very convoluted history on a really personal level. So I think trying to dig through those issues, you know, and that's part of the reason why there are so many people who have kind of put themselves in a camp and won't budge in terms of whether they think Stan Lee is good or bad, whether they think Kirby deserves X amount of credit or Y amount of credit. It's interesting, you know, when you look at something as it's become more important in popular culture, comic books have you know, generated more of a sub-industry, and you're talking about the history of comics and characters and all this kind of thing. So there's still a lot of unanswerable and mysterious questions out there, which I think is part of the fun of the whole thing.
Well, Bob Batchelor, I think you did a fabulous job in telling this story of this great era and this great guy. The book is called Stan Lee, The Man Behind Marvel, and the author, my guest, Bob Batchelor. Thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, I appreciate it. It's been my pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Bob Batchelor. He's the author of Stan Lee, The Man Behind Marvel. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we'll see you next week.